This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. 2021 marks 20 years since the first sequencing of the human genome was published back in February 2001. And in the past two decades, the Human Genome Project has played a huge role in advancing medical research. But even when the project ended, you know, the human reference genome that was published wasn't really finished. So what lies ahead for research in this field and why does it matter? So that will be our topic on today's Brainwave segment. And as always, neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar is back on the show to help us understand the contributions that the project has, the contributions of the project over the past two decades, and you know what lies ahead for the field. How are you doing today, Dr. Azlina?
I'm good. Thank you so much. And I hope everyone is staying safe.
Yes, so hopefully everyone is staying safe, you know, get registering for the vaccine and getting vaccinated when their turn comes.
And wait for things to go back to normal.
Yes, definitely. But in the meantime, you know, on our topic for today, we're taking a look, we're sort of taking a step back into history. We're taking a look at something that was a huge step forward in the field, the Human Genome Project. And for people who aren't familiar, Dr. Azlina, perhaps could you explain what is the Human Genome Project and why was it started back then in 1990?
Yeah, so actually the Human Genome Project is almost as important, if not more important than any, you know, NASA-driven space exploration, you know, journey to the moon, because it really is, it was a project to understand humans more, you know, our genetic makeup, our recipe book. You know, what is encoded in this recipe book? What is stored? What makes you different from me? You know, the variation that exists with between individuals. And also things like, you know, migration and ancestry and how related different populations are, even how related are humans to other species, you know? So it was really a very powerful and very, very important initiative to have been conducted.
Mm. So, you know, the project started in 1990. They published that first draft sequence in 2001, and then it ended in 2003. Could you briefly explain sort of what were the researchers doing during that period, and what did they achieve by the end of it for it to be such a landmark project, like you mentioned?
Yeah, so actually the story of the Human Genome Project is one of the most fascinating stories, right? Because it really is like a drama. There were so many people involved and so many twists and turns. And I really recommend, actually, there's a very good documentary. It's a little bit old now, but actually it gives a really good overview. So if you just, if anyone's interested, they can Google PBS Human Genome Project. And they really give a very nice kind of overview about the people who were involved and the initial motivation behind it and all the drama and controversy that happened, right? Mm. So just to kind of give a short summary, actually, there were a number of people in America who first proposed the idea, right? Mm. And it came off from some of these smaller sequencing projects that had been done on yeast, right, and also the worm. So there were these small groups in the UK and also in the US who had sequenced the DNA of worms and yeast. And the reason why they started with those was because those were the organisms that they were working on for their research, but also because the DNA is much smaller. Mm-hmm. So it was easier to do. But those projects actually showed the human geneticist community that it was possible, right, to do a genome sequencing project. And the human genome actually has roughly about 3 billion letters, as we call it, or 3 billion nucleotides, right? Mm-hmm. Or we can just call it letters, okay, to make it simple. So in the human genome, or any genome, actually, we have four letters. Okay. In our DNA, all the information is only carried by four letters, A, T, G, and C. And they stand for the sort of different components, okay, which I won't go into today. Okay, but the different combinations of just four letters is what makes all the proteins that we need. So, for example, sometimes it is A, T, T, G, right? Sometimes it is T, T, A, G. You know, so you can have like different combinations of what we call a sequence. And in our human genome, we have 3 billion. We mm-hmm. have 3 billion of that sequence. And so you can imagine that back in the 1990s, the machines that would have been required to do that kind of work didn't actually really exist then. You know, and they were using very simple methods, okay, that was very laborious, that took a long time to do. But it was initially kind of started off, strangely enough, by the US Department of Energy, and they called together groups of geneticists who had been working on the worm and the yeast projects. And they kind of tried to troubleshoot. And actually also one of the co-discoverers of the structure of the DNA helix, James Watson, he was also involved in the initial Human Genome Project. He played quite a major role in getting money, okay, and funding to help to drive the project. So anyway, so then what happened was the initial project was funded by the government, by the public, okay, which is the taxpayer money, and so the government gave money.
And this was in the US?
Yes, this was in the US. And actually, they also had other centers across the world that they were working with very closely, a group in the UK at the Wellcome Research Institute. And then they were also working with people in Japan mm-hmm. at the Riken Institute and quite a number of sites within US. So there was like the Washington and then Washington University, and then they also had the NIH and also some research institutes. And so they were all working together, but then what happened, right? And this is where it gets really interesting and it becomes really like a drama, right? Is where suddenly this a man known as Craig Venter. Okay, and he announced that he was setting up a privately run mm-hmm. Initiative to do this Human Genome Project. And he said, you know, look, you know, you guys are doing it too slowly, right? And it has to be faster, because if we follow the pace that you're doing it at, you know, we're not going to be able to get anything in even 20 or 30 years. So he said, you know, let's do it. Let's do it quickly, and I'll and as a private entity, he was going to get funding to get all the necessary machines. But what he was going to do was that he was then going to make people pay if they wanted to access that information, right? Mm-hmm. And so this went totally against what the public initiative was doing, because the public initiative very strongly felt that because it was being funded by, you know, the government or the taxpayers, mm-hmm. that whatever information that they got, that they were going to share it publicly, right? And so you had all these like websites and databases set up where every time they got information, they would post it or upload it so that people could immediately access it, mm-hmm. okay, free of charge. Right, but Craig Venter, when he set up his company known as Celera, he said, you know, we're going to do it. We're going to do it better. We're going to do it faster. But if you want it, you have to pay. And so, of course, you know, there was this huge argument about, you know, monetizing the human genome, because, you know, is it ethical? And so there was this great kind of debate and of course, you know, animosity lah, to a certain degree between the private and the public. But actually, what came out from Craig Venter kind of stepping up mm-hmm. and saying that he was going to do this private thing was that the public run initiative suddenly started to accelerate, right? And they said, oh my, you know, we can't leave it all up to him because then that's going to be bad. Mm. So what they did was they had like a number of negotiations where the equipment that the private company was going to have access to, the public initiative was able to negotiate to also have access to those equipment in order that they could do it as fast as the public. And so there were many other things that sort of came about, you know, many other negotiations that had to take place. But eventually what happened was, as you mentioned, right, in February 20 years ago, they published separately. Mm. So the public initiative was published in a journal known as Nature, which is a prestigious journal. Mm-hmm. And then the privately run project was published in Science, also another prestigious journal. And they both presented their data. Mm-hmm. So it's a really fascinating story. And like I said, I would recommend anyone, you know, who is interested in history at all, who's interested in the Human Genome Project to look up, you know, there's a lot of things that have been written up about that aspect of the Human Genome Project.
Hmm. And why is that Human Genome Project, you know, the results that were published 20 years ago still so significant today?
I think because, so actually it was, number one, the very first time it had ever been done, of course, on a human genome. And actually, I do have to say that when we talk about the human genome, the data that was released, mm-hmm. okay, it wasn't just on a single individual, because the very, very first one was on, I think, something like 8 to 11 individuals. Mm-hmm. So they got these people who obviously would have volunteered and they consented to having their DNA sequenced and publicly shared, right? But of course, anonymous, so you wouldn't be able to tell which sequence belongs to who exactly. But now, so that even with just 11 people or so, right, the amount of information that we got was very significant. At that time, it was very significant. Now, actually, when we look back, and if you look at the information that they presented now, that with all the new technology and new information and analysis tools that we can do now, when you look back at those papers, you go, oh, actually, you know, there were some things that got wrong, you know, some things that they didn't fully, they weren't able to describe because of the limitations of the technology at the time. But it was very powerful, I think, and a very important driver for a lot of future projects and a lot of these sort of offshoot projects that happen from this initial project itself.
Hmm. And I will get to those offshoot projects and the limitations in a bit. We'll go for a quick break now. I'm speaking to neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar for her monthly Brainwave segment. Today, we're taking a look at the Human Genome Project as this year is the 20th anniversary of the publication of its results all the way back in 2001. We'll be right back after a few messages. Keep it here on Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. It's our Brainwaves segment of the month. And as always, joining me today is neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar. And today we're taking a look at the Human Genome Project and what has happened in the 20 years since the results were published in two very prestigious journals, as Dr. Azlina mentioned earlier, in the journal Nature and Science. You know, before the break, Dr. Azlina was giving us an overview of the history of the project. But now let's move on to, you know, what sort of contributions and the offshoot projects that have emerged from it. Dr. Zina, how did the project sort of benefit in advanced science, especially in medical research? You know, what sort of offshoot projects, you know, really stood out to you?
Yeah, so actually, even in 2001, mm-hmm. it changed many people's lives already, right? I when I was doing my PhD, so this was in 2001, and I was doing my PhD at the time, and I was in my second year, and I remember Craig Venter actually came to the university where I was doing my PhD, and we met up with him, and he's a very unusual man. he hardly blinks when you talk to him. He just sort of like, you feel like, you know, he's staring at you, you know. And so I remember, of course, my friends and I at the time, we were very overwhelmed by being in his presence. And I think all we said was, you know, well, you know, thank you so much for all your effort. And, you know, you really changed, you just dramatically changed the course of our PhD projects, right? Because before we had access to the information that came from this project, you know, it was, as I mentioned, very laborious. Mm. You know, you had every, like, if you were a student, you wanted to have that piece of sequence, you had to generate it yourself. You had to do the very step-by-step experiment, you know, whereas now, like, my PhD students, they just go, you know, go to a website, go to a database, click, 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 and then they have it in 5 minutes, you know, and the wealth of information that they have access to now as well is really extraordinary compared to what it was. So, you know, even just the Human Genome Project itself, you know, was so valuable. You know, so many people were spurred on by the sudden availability of information. And, you know, expectations, of course, increase because now they're like, well, you know, it's easy for you to get this information, so you should be doing more. But then it helped us discover more, of course. So that made it much more exciting because then you spent a lot more time in interpreting rather than, you know, having to generate the raw data yourself. So that was really very, very exciting. But I guess just to sort of say, you know, some of the basic things that came out even very early on from the Human Genome Project was like even the number of genes, right, that we have as a human, you know, people had these sort of estimates beforehand. And if I were to ask you, Su-Ann, you know, in I'll put you on the spot, maybe you know, how many genes do you think the human genome has? Okay, as a clue, let me help you, okay, that the mouse has about 20,000 genes, right? So how many do you think the human would have?
Oh gosh, I feel like I've heard you say this to me before. Now I feel like I feel like the student that has forgotten the material. is it less, fewer genes than the mice?
Fewer genes than the mouse. Why would you say that?
Well, I must admit, I'm purely guessing here.
You're just purely guessing. Yeah, actually, a lot of the time people would estimate more because they go at the mouse and they go, well, if the mouse has 20,000, surely us as humans, we should have, you know, exponentially. So people will sort of say, you know, 100,000 or even 500,000. Okay, but one of the really surprising things that came about was from their initial estimation of the number of human genes was that they said, you know, we have about 25,000, you know, and people were really surprised and they, you know, they kept recalculating and they said, this can't be right because we know that in the mouse it's 20,000. How can we only have 5,000 genes more than the mouse? Because, you know, surely, you know, we're so special. But that was what they came up with at the time. Now, 20 years later, okay, we now have different ways of interpreting what we recognize as a gene. Okay, so that number, depending on who you ask and depending on who is doing the analysis, can vary somewhat. Okay, so for example, if you take a very strict definition of what a gene is, and some people say, well, a gene, I will only count a sequence as being a gene if it produces a protein, right? So if you remember, maybe from school, you have a gene and then the gene makes a product known as an RNA, right? And then after that, then that RNA product is translated or becomes a protein, and actually in our cells, then the main players that drive the workings of the cell are proteins, right? So if you only go with that very strict definition, then you would have a lower number of genes, right? But if you open up and you say, well, I'm going to accept any sequence that makes any kind of product, right? Even if it doesn't eventually become a protein, but if it remains as an RNA, that intermediate, okay? Because now, actually, scientists are recognizing that there's a lot of things that happen in the cell that are also driven by these RNA products. So these RNA products are no longer just intermediate, you know, just waiting to be transformed into a prince protein, right? Mm. They actually, the frog, right, can actually do something. This RNA product can be really important in many, many different functions of the cell. So if you open up that definition to also include these, then there are some estimates saying that we can have up to about 50,000 of sequences that we would accept as what we would call a gene. So even, you know, I'm just sort of explaining that because even now there's still a debate, you know, just maybe 2 or 3 years ago, people were still, you know, releasing and publishing papers sort of describing different analysis and, you know, different interpretations of that. The other thing that was really very important that came up from the Human Genome Project was also the distribution of where these genes are. And they found, okay, also a very interesting discovery was that only about 2 to 3% of our genome are genes, right? Or are these sequences that we think of as genes, meaning that they make something.
Mm-hmm.
That about 97% of our genome is kind of like we don't really know what it does, but what happened is one of the offshoot projects from the Human Genome Project is that people are now trying to understand, okay, wow, you know, why are we carrying around 97% of something that doesn't appear to have any active role to play? And in actual fact, another project, so the offshoot project is something that's called ENCODE, mm-hmm. ENCODE, and that is a project where people are trying to understand this 97%, what is it actually involved in? And actually, now we know that 97% is crucial, right? So there's no way that anyone could survive if you only took the 2 to 3%, which is genes,
mm-hmm.
and you tried to kind of make an artificial organism carrying only that information. That organism would not survive, right? So it's really critical to have that additional information. Okay, and what does that additional information do? It actually acts as these switches, okay? It tells the genes when to turn on and off, and it kind of like acts as a like a dial, you know, like we have these like dimmer switches for our lights at home,
mm-hmm.
okay? Or you can think of a volume dial. You know, if you want to make more of a particular product, an RNA product or a protein, then you can like dial up, you know, so you can, there are regions within this 97% of our DNA that control when and where and how much of these products are being made. So that as one of an offshoot project, that is one of the really important ones that has come out. And then if I can just mention one more,
mm-hmm.
about people are also very interested in that. I'm sure you've heard that, you know, if we look at the DNA, you know, we are kind of around about 98.6% similar, right, at the sequence level. But,
you know, similar to each other?
Yes, similar to each other, yeah. Yeah, so, but why do we all look very different?
Yes.
You know, and so that was also something that was that people were curious about. So what is the variation that can be present in the genome that can account for the diversity that we have in terms of our features, you know? But I suppose one thing I do have to mention is that, you know, when you think of absolute numbers, even though in reality we are 1.3% different, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that 1.3% is, when you look at it, over 3 billion letters, that actually accounts for a lot of variation.
So it's still a huge number.
Yes, yes. So it's still a lot. There's a lot that is different between individuals, and also different individuals. So everybody has their own slightly, right? You would have inherited the DNA, of course, from your parents, but you yourself, right, because of changes that would have happened in the derm cells, so the egg or the sperm, right? Everybody carries a unique, maybe about, I think they estimated about 4 or 5 unique new changes, right, that happen that isn't present in your parents. So it was really very exciting, you know. So now there are many offshoot projects trying to understand, like, how the genome actually works, number one, and how much and what is the variation, and how does that variation lead to differences in things like just even, you know, the way we look, the way we behave, our susceptibility to diseases, you know, and so many other things.
So I guess in that sense, you know, it's also enabled better and wider clinical research, right? Because we have all this information available to researchers.
Absolutely. So all these sort of newspaper articles that come out, you know, that this particular gene has been associated with, you know, a particular disease or a variant, I must say, within a particular gene has been associated with whatever, you know, depression or neurodegenerative disease, or even recently they published for COVID-19, of course, you know, what they call the genetic susceptibility. So why is it that some people, when they are infected with the virus, why do some of them have quite severe reaction to it compared to others, right? So people are trying to understand that much more clearly. And how you do that is that, you know, you really can access the information now that is available about the variation that is present in our human genome. And there's a lot, you know, actually, I think I mentioned it in some of the earlier shows, but there's a lot of variation that is present. And I just want to also say, in terms of it, you know, the cost of the Human Genome Project, I think back in 2001, I think the people reported the cost of actually sequencing just the 11 or so individuals for this, what we call the reference genome. That cost the U.S. government like $3 billion.
Wow.
$3 billion U.S. dollars. Yeah, yeah. So $3 billion U.S. dollars for 3 billion letters, right? But actually, because of, you know, the companies that were that were manufacturing the machines to do this kind of sequencing, they improved over time, and they were able to upscale, you know, the production of the machine. So actually the cost now of doing that has dramatically decreased. And actually just recently, you know, the cost of, if you wanted, Sue-Ann, if you wanted your genome to be sequenced, what we call a whole genome sequencing, that would be something like $20,000, ringgit.
Still a huge sum, but I guess not as much as $3 billion US dollars.
So now, because the cost has decreased a lot, you know, that actually has helped with the discovery of genes. And that has really helped in, as you mentioned, you know, understanding more about what particular genes are responsible for particular diseases. And the other offshoot one is also now with all these commercial genetic testing companies.
Yes. Okay,
they also actually have been able to use information that has come about from research that has used the Human Genome Project to discover these new genetic associations with one particular change in that one gene with this particular behavior or phenotype or symptom or disease. And they are now offering that to the general public. So that's how the landscape has really changed, you know, over the course of 20 years.
Mm. I think it's really interesting to see how this was such a huge undertaking 30 years ago. And then we've sort of moved from, you know, from countries having to spend $3 billion on the project to now people being able to relatively easily access these commercial genetic testing. I think it's quite incredible to see how much has changed.
Mm. I have to say that because some of the research is still very new, you know. Just to mention that for some of the things that are offered by the genetic, the commercial genetic testing companies, some of that is not 100% confirmed yet. Mm. You know, I mean, that sometimes the variants that they look at are predicted, right? So it's predicted to be associated with a particular disease or with a particular trait or characteristic, but we can't say for sure. So that's why, to a certain extent, sometimes some of these kind of results that we get back, particularly for those general characteristics, like I said, like attitude, you know, things like, are you a risk taker? Are you, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, what I'm trying to say is, sometimes, you know, you have to take to a certain extent some of the results with a pinch of salt.
Mm.
Because especially those that are dealing with characteristics, those haven't been fully understood by scientists to be able to make a direct link.
Mm. I think that's a whole other topic that, you know, can generate
Absolutely.
A whole other discussion, right? I mean, that's something that's sort of become so popular. But let's also look at the limitations that have emerged from the Human Genome Project. You know, one of the things that stood out to me when I was researching this was the fact that even at the end of the project, when the project was completed, the sequence was not, I read that about 15% was still considered missing at the time. And then over time, you know, researchers have sort of solved more of the puzzle, but it's still not complete. What's the reason behind that? You know, what exactly was missing?
Two things. So that was because of two things. Number one was because of the technology. There were some limitations in the technology of the early equipment that was being used. And another one is just because some parts of the human genome are trickier to sequence,
mm-hmm.
right? And those parts, you require a slightly different approach. So, for example, now, and this is a development which has happened over a number of years, and it wasn't part of the initial sequence that was in 2001. So, for example, now we know that when we use kind of like these standard platforms or standard techniques to sequence the human genome, we will have some missing information. But we know that if you want to fill the gap, we need to use a different method in order to cover those regions, right? Because like I said, it's just the property of the DNA at that part is difficult to access. So you can only sequence DNA if you can actually get close enough to it. Right.
Mm.
And if you can only get nice, readable data from it. So the problem was with some of these regions is that they have what we call very highly repetitive regions. So when you try to use a conventional method to pick it up, it comes back very messy. So it was unreliable. Right. And probably that's why in the initial draft or in the subsequent drafts, you know, after that, a few years after that, they didn't include it because you cannot make sense of it.
Mm.
But now, actually, even now, you know, my students, when they want to access the information, you know, we have to be careful about what we call the version of the human genome reference that we're using, because even now they're constantly updating every few years or so. And that is really driven by the latest technologies that we are using to be able to access these very difficult to read parts of the human genome. Even like in the last year or so, people are still publishing, you know, the latest version of it. So that's going to be an ongoing thing. For a number of years. So actually the reference genome that we are using is not, we haven't actually read the entire 3 billion letters yet, that there are still a few pockets that we don't know about.
I mean, I came across this this article that was talking about a recent study, which I think is still in preprint, that, you know, researchers have said that they have now managed to sequence the remainder of the human genome. I mean, could that be significant? And is it possible to really, for us to, you know, completely sequence the human genome one day?
Yes. We could. However, as I mentioned, we have to be aware that, you know, how many billion individuals are there on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
And every one of us has a slightly different sequence, right? So actually the one that they would have completed would have been on just a number of individuals, right? So we would have completely sequenced their genomes, but no one's looked at my genome, no one's looked at your genome, right? And you and I carry variants that may not be present in these individuals, right? So the other kind of offshoot project that has come about as well, that is what they call, that they're doing these like 1,000 genomes. So they're trying to get 1,000 individuals. I think this has been a long ongoing project already. 1,000 individuals from many different parts of the world, right? Representing different ethnicities. So you have like the Caucasians, right? And then you have the East Asians, you have the Africans, you have the Pacific Islanders, for example, and the South Americans. And so you want to capture as much variation. And that is really important. So in a way, yes, they would have completely sequenced the genome of those individuals that they used, but it would not be of the entire human race, if you know what I mean.
That would be another major undertaking.
Absolutely. And so that's why, you know, there's always going to be updates to information, to the information that we get. Because the more individuals we sequence, the more we're going to find out about the different types of variations that are present, where they happen, and what is the impact that it would have on, you know, whatever trait or disease that a person would have.
What do you think lies ahead in genomic research? You know, what are you perhaps most excited about that you think, you know, researchers could look into more?
I think from a healthcare perspective, you know, the people who are working on the medical genetics side, you know, we really hope that we're going to be able to interpret the data that we get well enough that we're able to provide, you know, what we call predictive genetic testing, right, to a certain extent. That would be useful for us, that if, you know, it would almost be like a blood test, right? So you could screen individuals. And actually, that's already been done for some cancers. And you could kind of, you know, have a panel of genes that we could screen, and then we could predict many things, right? Number one, what is the risk of a person developing that particular disease? I mean, with very good accuracy, right? I mean, like I said, some of the commercial genetic testing companies, they appear to offer that. But like I said, from the research point of view, a lot of that is still, not confirmed. Mm. So it would, from our point of view, we would really like to get to a point where we are comfortable with being able to look at someone's genetic profile and be able to make, you know, fairly accurate predictions about, number one, how they would respond to a particular drug, right, which is a field known as pharmacogenomics. And then number two is whether or not we could predict how that disease would progress and whether or not there would be certain features of that disease that that person is likely to develop that we could then try to intervene early on, either from therapeutic drugs or any intervention like lifestyle intervention. So that would be really wonderful. And other things like people are very interested in ancestry, right? How related are we to people, in different parts of the world and where did we come from? And that is something already that's been done by these commercial companies. And I think the more we sequence many people from different parts of the world, the richer the information is going to be and the more accurate the prediction or the association, let's say, we can come up with exactly you are related to Eskimos, for example, or you're related to someone, perhaps, in Philippines or in Thailand, how closely related are you to them? And that's always going to be something that a lot of people are going to be curious about. And of course, then, we don't have time probably to go into the more science fiction things that might come out from all the things that we discover. Mm. Yeah, but lots of really exciting things, I think, in the future. And it's really a really exciting time to be part of it all.
Mm. I think especially what you mentioned right up front, right, about the predictive genetic testing. I think a lot of that's always been mentioned quite often in research. I think, do you think we're far off from reaching that goal?
I mean, I think for some, we are there already.
Mm-hmm. Yes, like cancer, right, you mentioned?
Yeah, that's right. And even then, with the BRCA1, for example, that's not, for example, even if you have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, that's not 100% certain individuals. There are many other things that people need to look at. They need to look at your family history. They need to look at, what are the other types of cancers that your relatives had, whether or not, that is relevant to the BRCA1, for example. So even if you come back with a positive result from BRCA1, it doesn't mean 100%, so even like, the case of Angelina Jolie, she had an 80% or so risk of developing, it wasn't 100%, so those kind of things are going to still be things that we're going to have to think about more carefully and learn how to interpret better. And, that can only come through more and more research. The larger, the more we replicate the early findings of other studies, is it relevant to our population? Which changes are more relevant to Asians compared to those in other ethnicities, because we're also finding those differences, right? So we have to be very careful, and that can only come with more and more research that's being done. So still a lot to do, still a lot to do, but a lot that the information that came from the Human Genome Project, everything that has come out from it, the advances in technology, the human resource that we now have in order to help to analyze all the things, and the sheer scale of the numbers of people who are now taking part in these studies, that all is going to contribute. So it's very exciting.
Yes, it's exciting times to live in. It'll be really exciting to see what researchers continue to come up with, and we are seeing great results every year. So, I think we're all looking forward to see what changes and how this will revolutionize the medical field.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, Dr. Azlina.
My pleasure. Thank you. I hope we kind of cleared up some things and got everybody excited about the Human Genome Project.
Yes. I've been speaking to neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar for her monthly Brainwave segment. And today we've been taking a look at the Human Genome Project and what we've learned over the past 20 years and what are the exciting things that lie ahead. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.